You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here from CorbettReport.com in a conversation that is being recorded on the 22nd of September, 2016. And as we sit here in late September, 2016, you may or more likely may not note that this is the 15th anniversary of a terror attack of some sort or other. Not 9/11, which of course was a couple of weeks ago, but a different terror attack that has largely been swept under the rug because it turned out to be an inconvenient narrative that didn't quite go in with to the war on terror narrative that we were seeing build up at that time. I'm referring, of course, to the anthrax attacks, which took place from late September to early October of 2001 and was initially seen to be a part of the 9/11 wave of terror that people were expecting. And I don't know about people out there in the audience and what their own personal experiences of it was. I do remember quite vividly being a glorified secretary in a commercial real estate office at that time, who part of my daily routine was to open the mail. So there were a lot of jokes about what to do if I ever encountered any white powder coming out of any packages. They were jokes of a kind, but this was obviously something that was dominating the news at that time. And that's why I found it quite interesting that that soon got swept under the rug and forgotten about so thoroughly. And so I have covered it on the Corbett Report a number of times in the past. For example, episode 18 of the podcast, interview 864 with Dr. Merrill Nass, and interview 944 with Dr. Graham McQueen, who people might remember from a couple of conversations that we've had in the past. We are going to be talking to Dr. Graham McQueen again today, talking about the anthrax attacks and about his very important work on that subject, the 2001 Anthrax Deception, a very, very thorough and very well-written book on those attacks. Again, that was the subject of our previous conversation, so please do go back and re-listen to that conversation if you haven't heard it yet. Dr. McQueen, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, it's great to talk to you again, James.
All right. So as I say, these attacks did come in the context of 9/11 and the unfolding of the beginning of what was to become the War on Terror, and was very much seen in that context at the time. And as they were taking place, no one had any clue what was happening, where they were coming from, what this really meant. And there were a lot of theories going around at that time, and a lot of people trying to puzzle their way through this. In chapter 5 of your book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, you lay out a few of the basic main hypotheses about the perpetrator or perpetrators of this attack. First, let's start this conversation by just going through and rehashing some of those hypotheses and what people were thinking about at the time.
Sure. Well, I felt that people who studied these attacks went much too quickly to the question of, did Bruce Ivins do it? You know, this is the guy that the FBI eventually claimed was the anthrax killer. Or did somebody else do it? Or did Al-Qaeda do it? And so I wanted to take a step back. So I just drew a little grid, you know, with four main possibilities. So was it a foreign perpetrator? And if so, was it an individual or a group? Or was it a domestic perpetrator? In which case, was it an individual or a group? So you have four main options with some possibility of mixture, but those are the four main options. And so I wanted to show in the book what had actually happened historically, which of those perpetrators had been considered the most plausible at any given moment. And the broad sweep is that the U.S. government, U.S. intelligence, U.S. media were very strongly inclined in the early stages toward the foreign group, okay? I mean, that's obviously what the war on terror requires. It requires a foreign group. You know, it requires Al-Qaeda, it requires Iraq, that sort of thing. A group includes state here, so I put Iraq under that category as well. And a domestic individual isn't all that interesting, but a domestic individual is very useful as a fallback position if your initial hypothesis doesn't work. So that's what the FBI did. They went from foreign group, oh my God, this is falling apart, to domestic individual, which is the loan nut, and it's pretty safe. You can always go there. No one was ever interested in the possibility of the foreign individual, so that quadrant pretty much drops out. And that leaves one quadrant, which is the domestic group. And my whole book really is an argument in favor of reviving the domestic group hypothesis. I think it's perfectly clear. I mean, everyone now admits it was domestic. And I think it's perfectly clear it couldn't have been a domestic individual. It was a domestic group. And it was a domestic group with high-level access in the U.S. government, deeply embedded in the military intelligence industrial complex. All of these things, I think, are pretty easy to show. And so that's really the thrust of my book. But if you're talking about what was popular when, about 15 years ago, this is what, September 22nd today. So 15 years ago, the U.S. was in the middle of a very strange period when you think about it. No anthrax had actually been presented to anyone. No one was known to be sick from anthrax 15 years ago today, right? The first time anthrax was actually announced to the public that someone had the disease was October 4th. But letters had been put in the mail with anthrax in them somewhere around September 18th. So what we would expect is that there wouldn't be any talk of anthrax 15 years ago today. Wouldn't be any talk of it until October 4th, right? Because these letters were making their way through the mail, but nobody knew it, and they didn't know they had, you know. The truth is quite different. The truth is that the mention of anthrax began immediately after the 9/11 attacks, escalated through September. For example, I have a Washington Post headline from, or sorry, not headline, but article from September 17th, okay, which is a very interesting date. It's almost exactly when somebody is putting anthrax in the mail. And this Washington Post article says, bioterrorism, an even more devastating threat, meaning more devastating than 9/11. And the article specifically mentions anthrax. By September 26th, there is an actual full-fledged anthrax scare happening in the United States. There are so many people running out to get the antibiotic Cipro that the druggists say they can't keep it in stock. So, in other words, yeah, 15 years ago from now, an anthrax scare was beginning in the United States under the strangest circumstances, since indeed there was anthrax in the mail, but no one was supposed to have known about it.
Very puzzling, again, if one wants to believe that this was some sort of outside attack. But again, as we know, there was a domestic element to it. We just don't know the exact nature of that domestic element. But if people do remember anything about these attacks, they probably remember seeing the notes that were presented in the New York Post, NBC News letters, as well as the letters addressed to Senators Daschle and Leahy, which were, of course, labeled 9/11/01, this is next, take penicillin now, death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great, which obviously cemented in the public imagination the certitude that this came from Islamic terrorists. Tell us a little bit about those notes and what they did to play into this, the developing theories about who actually perpetrated these events.
Yes, well, again, we have two different modes of study. One is what was actually happening, and one is what do I think now, after having all that study, was the narrative that we were supposed to accept. Let's begin with the narrative that I think we were supposed to accept. I think it's quite clear that what I call the double perpetrator hypothesis was meant to win the day. A double perpetrator hypothesis is quite simple. It just means that Al-Qaeda, right, the same people that supposedly did the 9/11 attacks, had a hand in the anthrax attacks. They had written those stupid letters, for example, with misspellings and clumsiness, and you know, they'd put the little letters with poor printing in the mail. And so that was Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda could not have made this very sophisticated product. And so an actual anthrax letter held a kind of contradiction in it, a crude piece of text combined with a very sophisticated product. The anthrax spores, especially the ones sent to the two senators, were weaponized in possibly the most sophisticated way ever seen. You know, microencapsulation, use of silicone, ways of getting rid of static charge so they wouldn't clump together, all kinds of aerosolization so that they would drift along like smoke. For example, you mentioned being in the position of opening mail. Well, the young woman who opened Senator Daschle's mail in mid-October was very frightened because as she opened it, this white stuff came out. It didn't just fall on the floor. It drifted out of the envelope like smoke. And quite quickly, the entire Hart Senate building was contaminated and had to be closed for several months. So everyone said, oh, well, Al-Qaeda can't do that. They can't produce that. So who could have produced that? Well, it had to be a state, obviously. Let's see. What state could it have been? And we didn't have to wait very long to hear, oh, gee, Iraq had an anthrax program. They weaponized anthrax. This is obviously Iraq as the supporter of Al-Qaeda. And this fit with a narrative which certain people had been trying to push from very early, namely that this same double perpetrator had also carried out the 9/11 attacks, that Iraq was always standing there in the background as the sponsor, the supporter of Al-Qaeda. And this was supported through a number of false narratives, including Muhammad Atta in Prague, right? Remember that one? That was in circulation for months. Supposedly, the head of the hijackers had met an Iraqi, high-level Iraqi, I don't remember, diplomat or intelligence agent, in Prague before 9/11, and they were obviously working together. So I think the way the story was supposed to go is that both 9/11 and anthrax, we were supposed to believe, had been carried out by this double perpetrator. And that set things up very nicely for two invasions, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq. And so the anthrax attacks were supposed to have played a very, very important role in terms of foreign policy. And before I end this little monologue, they were also supposed to play a very important role domestically. I mean, the Patriot Act was introduced into Congress shortly after the 9/11 attacks, but it was pretty clear that something else was going to be necessary if it was going to get through without being mangled really badly. It was being slowed down. It was being forced to go through committees. And that's where the anthrax attacks came in. And they were very handy, and they provided a direct physical threat to Congress, right? Two senators being sent anthrax letters. And so the Patriot Act was passed under that pressure late in October 2001. So we mustn't forget these anthrax attacks because they were part of a narrative that was supposed to serve a very important role both externally and domestically in the U.S. by the perpetrators.
And they did serve that role, regardless of the fact that most of the narrative that was based on turned out to be incorrect. And just to fill in the blank for people who don't remember that story about Muhammad Atta meeting Iraqi intelligence in Prague, that was confirmed rather quickly to be a complete lie. Certainly by the mid-2002, it was even in the press admitted to have been a lie, but still had served a propagandistic function and was probably part of what informed people, the general public's perception of Iraq's role or potential role in 9/11 and even the anthrax attacks at that time. So let's examine that narrative in a little bit more detail. So the idea here, the double perpetrator hypothesis, it was Al-Qaeda in conjunction with Iraq that used this Iraqi-developed, highly specialized, weaponized anthrax to commit these attacks. At what point did that narrative begin to start falling apart in the mainstream press?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the mainstream press because I was quite surprised when I wrote this book. I mean, I thought I had a sophisticated view of the U.S. media, but it turned out I didn't. I mean, they were much more complicit in this whole thing than even I had expected. For example, you could see signs of dissent and disagreement in the U.S. military and even occasionally in the U.S. intelligence. You find there's some honest people in there who are not going along with this. Whereas you have to work really hard to find such people in the mainstream press. It was all reported, you know, as if this is the truth. All the little press releases from government. So you had Senator McCain going on the David Letterman show in the evening saying, you know, it's looking like it's possible. You see, this is all done through gossip because they didn't have a shred of evidence. It's looking like it's possible that Iraq was behind these anthrax attacks. And of course, if that's true, then some hard decisions are going to have to be made, which is his way of saying we're going to invade the hell out of that country. So then we had a number of media, including the New York Times, collaborating in this whole business of it may be Iraq. But the strongest role was, in fact, there were media all over the world that were reporting that it looks like it may be Iraq. But ABC News certainly deserves special mention because they hung on to this story longer and they made strenuous efforts right through the end of October and into the beginning of November of 2001. ABC News said they had four high-level independent sources that said there was bentonite that had been discovered in the anthrax spores. Now, bentonite, although it was called, I forget what it was called, the powerful additive or something, is essentially clay. It's used in kitty litter, for example. It's not a dangerous substance, but it apparently Iraq used it in its anthrax, which, by the way, it had given up many years before. That is, it hadn't just given up bentonite, it had given up anthrax. But anyway, the point is ABC News was claiming this stuff was there. That's a very bold claim because it wasn't there. And almost immediately, they had to back down. And this is what I find interesting. Like, how did they think they'd get away with that? They must have thought, the perpetrators must have thought they had a greater control over scientists, all the relevant scientists, than in fact they did. So, for example, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology came out with a little report saying there's no bentonite here. So obviously there were some scientists with, I don't know, basic integrity who could look at the stuff and say, oh, this is all a lie. So quite quickly, the ABC story collapsed and the White House began saying, they began withdrawing from the Iraq hypothesis already in late October. Pretty much everyone stuck with it until the Patriot Act passed, which is, I can't remember, October 22nd or 24th, something like that. But as soon as the Patriot Act was got through, right, Bush had signed it into law, the whole anthrax story began to unravel. And the White House backed off from talking about Iraq. By the end of the year, by the end of December 2001, even Homeland Security was saying, you know what, it looks like there's a domestic source of these anthrax spores, which means really that both the Al-Qaeda and Iraq hypotheses were being abandoned by that time. And then the search, of course, had to be on for a safe alternative hypothesis.
You raise the important point of the puzzling nature of the way in which they attempted to brazenly lie about this anthrax in an attempt to frame a certain narrative about a perpetrator. And yes, it certainly does seem perplexing that they thought that they would be able to get away with such a brazen lie, unless, I suppose the other alternative is, maybe they didn't feel they had to get away with it in the end, as long as it made its way into the news cycle and became part of the public consciousness, which it certainly did. Again, perhaps I'm I'm on oddball here, but I do remember the talk of bentonite in Iraq at that time. And this is me 15 years later remembering this being floated around at that time. So it certainly served some sort of propagandistic purpose, even if it was a 100% outright bald-faced lie.
Well, you're right, James. Can I comment on that?
Please do.
I mean, obviously, the 9/11 attacks were similar. There were bald-faced lies there. I mean, and yet, up to now, they've sort of gotten away with it. I mean, you know, when you come up with a hypothesis that violates the basic laws of physics, I don't know what can be more brazen. In a way, the 9/11 lies are even more brazen. They really are. They're more brazen than the anthrax ones, because even the average person, even an ordinary person with a certain amount of sophistication, not a whole lot, you know, sort of a high school level, can do things like measure the descent of World Trade 7 and this sort of thing, and then can discover for themselves, you know, that this is a lie. With the anthrax, you couldn't do that. You had to, it was a battle of the experts. So, yeah, it's quite possible they didn't really care, ultimately, how absurd their claims were. What they wanted was a propaganda cycle. What they wanted was to be able to invade and get certain laws passed, all of which they did. You will remember that Colin Powell was still holding up his little vial of simulated anthrax shortly before he invaded, before the invasion of Iraq, and he was doing it in a beautifully propagandistic way. He didn't say, you know what, Iraq carried out the 2001 anthrax attacks. No, I mean, everyone knew that was false. So he just said, this amount of anthrax in this little vial closed down the whole Senate building in the fall of 2001. And this was all in the context of a conversation about how Iraq had stockpiles of anthrax, it had means of delivering anthrax, all of which was a lie, of course. So in the minds of people watching that, as you say, the implication would be, oh my God, Iraq is somehow connected to the anthrax attacks. We better get them.
Indeed, it's a Pavlovian conditioning at a certain point. Iraq, anthrax, Iraq, anthrax, Iraq, anthrax. And then all you have to do is say Iraq, and people will think, oh yeah, the anthrax attacks. So
that's correct.
I think, yeah, it did serve that purpose to a certain extent. Just generally then, can you comment on to what extent, I mean, obviously the Iraq invasion was brought forth on a number of different grounds, but to what extent do you think anthrax, even though the Iraqi connection had been long since abandoned, had an influence on at least the public's perception of that invasion?
Well, there may be polls on this, James, that directly address it, but I don't have any in front of me here, and I don't really want to speculate. So let me just back up a little bit and say, well, first of all, I will speculate. I'll say, sure, the anthrax attacks were very prominent in the U.S. for a short while and caused a lot of fear, and were certainly connected on television and in major news sources to Iraq. So, yes, I do think that many Americans considered them connected to the 9/11 attacks, and that in some vague way that they couldn't specify, they were both connected to Iraq. Now, if we look at this more closely and ask, you know, how big a propaganda effort was this to make these connections? Here we get into the study carried out by the Center for Public Integrity in the U.S., right, which looked at just two lies. First, the claim that Iraq was, in fact, a supporter of al-Qaeda. And secondly, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, right, at the time of the invasion of Iraq. And that would include anthrax. Anthrax was, after all, one of its major weapons of mass destruction. Well, the Center for Public Integrity looked at a number of high officials, as you know, in the U.S., from basically 9/11 till 2 years later. And how many false statements had they made in public on just those two topics? Well, the answer is 935. And the incidence of lies, let's put it this way, the lies became even thicker in the air, the more important the event. So, you know, leading up to the invasion of Iraq was one such time when all these lies were thick in the air. So what was this? It was clearly a well-coordinated propaganda campaign, which was meant to support the invasion of Iraq, among other things. And yes, the anthrax attacks, in my view, fit perfectly within that whole campaign. What were they supposed to prove? They were supposed to prove that Iraq had a weapon of mass destruction and was willing to use it on the U.S., right? And they were supposed to prove that Iraq was a sponsor indeed of Al-Qaeda. So those two lies that were told 935 times are actually central to the anthrax attacks. And I believe they had a big impact on the U.S. population through constant repetition. I can't measure it beyond that.
No, but yes, your points are well taken. And you're right. I mean, both the WMD lies and the Iraq Al-Qaeda lies directly impinge on this anthrax story that was being crafted. And even though, yes, it had been abandoned to one extent or another by the time of the invasion, it was still part of that linkage, I think, in people's minds. At any rate, the whole story of the anthrax investigation and all of that is obviously much too big for this particular conversation, so I will once again exhort people to go back and listen to our previous conversation, where we talked more about the fuller context of that investigation and your book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception. But since that conversation and since the publication of that book, there have been some interesting developments on this. It's not an ongoing investigation, at least not officially, but still, there are still ramifications and fallout from this, including a whistleblower from within that investigation called Richard Lambert. Can you just fill people in on Richard Lambert and what he revealed about this investigation?
Yes, my book came out, I guess it was the fall of 2014, and then the spring following that, spring of 2015, we got a former FBI officer, and he was also a lawyer, Richard Lambert, who decided to file a lawsuit against the FBI or certain parties within the FBI. And he was going to fight it himself because he was a lawyer, in fact. Now, what was that about? Well, what it was about was that Lambert left the FBI, and like a lot of FBI officers who leave the FBI, he tried to find jobs in security that would use his previous expertise. Well, he was attacked by a particular office of the FBI who claimed it was conflict of interest or something, I can't remember what, and essentially got him fired from the job he took after leaving the FBI. And they didn't just get him fired, they got him essentially blacklisted so that he couldn't get a job anywhere. And Lambert got angry because not only were they blacklisting him, they had also carried out an embarrassing investigation of him and gone through all kinds of files and came out with what he called prurient details and God knows what. They were trying to really smear him. And he said, you know why they're doing this? It's clear. It's because I'm a whistleblower on the anthrax case. He was high level. He was actually the head of the investigation for some period. And he said, the reason they don't like me and want to destroy me is because I said that this is not being carried out in a sincere way. You know, the investigation is not really being supported by the FBI. Furthermore, the case against Bruce Ivins, who was the chosen anthrax killer of the FBI, is weak. It's so weak, so weakly circumstantial that it would fail in a court of law. Of course, they didn't have to take it to law because Ivins conveniently died. But he said it would not have succeeded in court. And then finally, he said not only that, but the FBI is still sitting on a wealth of exculpatory evidence. In other words, they've got evidence which tends to exonerate Ivins, but they're not sharing it even today with the public. Well, now this is really important whistleblowing here. And this is all made, all these claims are made by Lambert in his written document. to the court. So this briefly interested one or two news agencies, and then, of course, dropped off the scene very quickly. But yes, it's confirmation of what I say in my book. I think it was already clear when I wrote the book that they didn't have a shred of decent evidence against Ivins, and that in any responsible court of law, they would have failed. I use the term responsible because, of course, the courts have been corrupted, and nowadays you don't know what's going to happen. But anyway, that was indeed a very important whistleblower. There were other developments since I finished the book, too. The GAO, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, finally came out with a much-delayed report. And I won't go into it in detail. It's actually a very boring and timid document. But if you read it carefully, what you realize is that they're saying the strongest evidence the FBI had against Ivins, right, which was supposedly the physical evidence that there was a relationship between the spores in a flask he was responsible for and the spores in the attack letters, okay? They say that's the strongest evidence they had, and yet that evidence is so weak that it probably wouldn't have even made it to court. In other words, what's called a Daubert hearing would have been held, where the person defending Ivins would have insisted on one of these hearings, where it is decided what scientific evidence is strong enough to make it to in front of a jury, let's say. And the GAO says, no, this wouldn't have made it at all in front of a jury. It's so weak. Well, you know, that's, again, it may be buried in boring prose, but it's a very important admission. So we have two different sources there, the GAO and Lambert, saying, in effect, the FBI has nothing on Ivins, and yet the man is dead. And officially, the FBI still calls him the anthrax killer, and they've closed the case. So obviously, the perpetrators, and as I say in my book, they are multiple, are at large.
And the only implication of this is that the FBI is actively covering up their identity, or covering the investigation that would find their identity. There is no other alternative here, especially given those two important sources, as you point out. Not that we needed them, but there they are.
Yeah. The FBI has become an accessory after the fact. Yes. In other words, even if they weren't actively involved in the anthrax attacks, they are covering up the perpetrators and therefore legally liable for that.
Well, I sincerely hope that people do not allow the anthrax attacks to be swept under the rug, because they do form an important part of this narrative, but just not in the way that they were intended to, I'm sure. Once again, I will exhort people to go and take a look at the 2001 anthrax deception, where you, again, I think you lay it out very concisely and in a lot of detail, a lot of footnotes for people who are interested in delving further into the research itself, which I always recommend. But I did a poor job of introducing you to the audience today, so perhaps you can fill them in on your role as co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies and any other work that you're participating in these days.
Right. Well, I was a university professor for about 30 years, and among other things was the founding director of a little institute called the Center for Peace Studies. So I was involved in studying war for a long time. But I took early retirement, and around 2005, 2006, began to devote myself almost full-time to studying the 9/11 attacks. And it was in that context that I really decided to look into the anthrax things, and have decided that that was really just a single operation with two parts, 9/11 and anthrax. So yeah, I'm now co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. I'm a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. I was on the steering committee of the Toronto hearings held 5 years ago, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I just would want to end by saying your metaphor here is a good one about sweeping the anthrax attacks under the rug. I'll just say to people, it's very dangerous to sweep anthrax under a rug. It doesn't go away. It can last for many, many generations.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, a very apt analogy, I suppose. All right. Well, we will leave the conversation there, but the research continues. I hope people will stay in touch with it and stay in touch with your work. And again, check out the Journal of 9/11 Studies if they haven't done so yet. Dr. Graeme McQueen, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you, James. Anytime.